welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It's Memorial Day weekend. Summer's here. And whether you're heading to the beach now or in a few weeks, I'm ready to suggest, shall we say, the first wave of your summer reads. Beach books are guilty pleasures, aren't they? It's your time to catch up on titles you've been hearing about and get suggestions from friends and me on which bestsellers to put in your beach bag. There's a whole show of page turners ahead, so let's turn now to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. In his international blockbusters, The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, and The Lost Symbol, Dan Brown masterfully fuses history, art, codes, and symbols. In his just-released and much-anticipated Inferno, Brown brings back Robert Langdon to do it all again. In the heart of Italy, Langdon, Harvard professor of symbology, is drawn into the harrowing world centered on one of history's most enduring and mysterious literary masterpieces, Dante's Inferno. Against this backdrop, Langdon battles a chilling adversary and grapples with a riddle that pulls him into a landscape of classic art and futuristic science. Drawing from Dante's dark, epic poem, Langdon races to find answers and decide whom to trust before the world is irreversibly altered. Paul Michael narrates.
The memories materialized slowly, like bubbles surfacing from the darkness of a bottomless well. A veiled woman. Robert Langdon gazed at her across a river whose churning waters ran red with blood. On the far bank, the woman stood facing him, motionless, solemn, her face hidden by a shroud. In her hand, she gripped a blue tania cloth, which she now raised in honor of the sea of corpses at her feet. The smell of death hung everywhere. "Seek," the woman whispered, "and ye shall find." Langdon heard the words as if she had spoken them inside his head. "Who are you?" he called out, but his voice made no sound.
"Time grows short," she whispered. "Seek and find."
Langdon took a step toward the river, but he could see the waters were blood red and too deep to traverse. When Langdon raised his eyes again to the veiled woman, the bodies at her feet had multiplied. There were hundreds of them now, maybe thousands. Some still alive, writhing in agony, dying unthinkable deaths, consumed by fire, buried in feces, devouring one another. He could hear the mournful cries of human suffering echoing across the water. The woman moved toward him, holding out her slender hands as if beckoning for help.
"Who are you?"
Langdon again shouted. In response, the woman reached up and slowly lifted the veil from her face. She was strikingly beautiful, and yet older than Langdon had imagined. In her 60s, perhaps, stately and strong, like a timeless statue. She had a sternly set jaw, deep, soulful eyes, and long, silver-gray hair that cascaded over her shoulders in ringlets. An amulet of lapis lazuli hung around her neck. A single snake coiled around a staff. Langdon sensed he knew her, trusted her. But how? Why? She pointed now to a writhing pair of legs, which protruded upside down from the earth, apparently belonging to some poor soul who had been buried head first to his waist. The man's pale thigh bore a single letter, written in mud. R.
R?
Langdon thought, uncertain. As in, Robert? Is that me? The woman's face revealed nothing.
Seek and find,
she repeated. Without warning, she began radiating a white light. Brighter and brighter, her entire body started vibrating intensely. And then, in a rush of thunder, she exploded into a thousand splintering shards of light. Langdon bolted awake, shouting. The room was bright. He was alone. The sharp smell of medicinal alcohol hung in the air. And somewhere, a machine pinged in quiet rhythm with his heart. Langdon tried to move his right arm, but a sharp pain restrained him. He looked down and saw an IV tugging at the skin of his forearm. His pulse quickened, and the machines kept pace, pinging more rapidly.
Where am I? What happened?
The back of Langdon's head throbbed, a gnawing pain. Gingerly, he reached up with his free arm and touched his scalp, trying to locate the source of his headache. Beneath his matted hair, he found the hard nubs of a dozen or so stitches caked with dried blood. He closed his eyes, trying to remember an accident. Nothing. A total blank.
We've just heard a sampling of Inferno by Dan Brown. David Baldacci burst onto the literary scene in 1996 with his first novel, Absolute Power. A movie adaptation followed with Clint Eastwood as its director and star. In total, David has published 25 novels, and there are more than 110 million copies of his work in print. David has also published 3 children's books. A lifelong Virginian, David received his bachelor's degree in poli-sci from Virginia Commonwealth University in 1982 and his law degree from UVA in 1986. He practiced law for 9 years in D.C. We'll be speaking with David today about his new bestseller, The Hit. Welcome, David. Thanks so much for joining us on The Book Report.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What made you pick up the pen to write your first novel, Absolute Power?
Well, you know, I've been writing stories since I was a kid. I went to law school to support myself. I didn't think I could make a living selling short stories. And I was working in Washington, D.C., and I worked near the White House, and I would pass by, and I thought about this story one day, just sort of hit me by the president and a burglar and a cover-up, and I spent 3 years writing it sort of in the middle of the night, you know, apart from the job that I had, and that really launched my career.
All right. Well, on to The Hit. Introduce us to Will Robey.
He was in a book I wrote last year called The Innocent. He's a government assassin, really excellent in his job. In this book, I take him to another level. He is tasked to send a killer to catch another killer. Jessica Real, a woman that he has worked with in the past, she's also an assassin, every bit as good as he is, has gone rogue, and she's killing members of her own agency, so they send Robey to terminate her. But the more he thinks about it and looks at it, he becomes unsure and doubtful about why she's doing what she's doing, doesn't know really where the truth is, and when you have doubt, you really can't pull the trigger. So it gets really complicated for Robey really fast.
When you introduced Will in The Innocent, did you feel in your bones you'd created a character you'd keep writing about?
I think so. When I was in the middle of writing The Innocent, I thought, this guy has a lot of legs. He's got a lot of juice left, and I really haven't even begun to explore his psyche and where he goes from here. So the Hit was a natural sort of evolution from The Innocent, how I ended that book, taking him and sort of pit him against a woman who knows him best. They do the exact same job. They're both damaged goods, emotionally sort of lost souls, to sort of delve deeper into his psyche and hers as well and see if there's a human being left under all this armor plating they've built up over the years. So, yeah, I knew early on that I was going to be bringing him back.
All right. Your home is not that far from D.C., or shall I say Langley. Is Will based on someone you've met?
Well, it's sort of a composite of different people. A lot of people, military and paramilitary, have this sort of special skill set. They're not going to tell you they go around and kill people, but you know that we have people who are tasked to do that. You look at SEAL Team 6, who was set out against Osama bin Laden. You look at the drone strikes that we use around the world. So these things do take place. It was my job as a fiction writer to sort of delve into the psyche of these people. And I needed you to root for people who killed other people, which is difficult. So I had to show that sort of human side, that vulnerable side, that damaged soul side that I think people can relate to and respond to.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Yes, Will is a killer, but he's a guy that you hope makes it through the end of the book. How do you respond to critics who say this specific genre desensitizes violence?
Well, I would say that when you actually focus on the damage and the toil that it takes on people, that you're actually doing the exact opposite of that. What I never want war to be turned into a video game where we just strike thousands of miles away and we might kill innocent people, but there's no harm that comes to us. I think it was either General Grant or General Lee who said, it's a good thing that war is so terrible, otherwise we would grow too fond of it. So for me, in my novels, I don't just have a hit guy running around blowing people away and then going back to having a normal life with kids and a barbecue and, you know, a soccer tournament. I show that when you have violence like this in your life, part of you is destroyed by it. So instead of, you know, being desensitized to it, I think there's a heightened awareness of violence has consequences, and violent action damages people, not only the people that the violence is directed against, but it's against the people who actually cause the violence too. I try not to take things from the headlines because the headlines keep changing, and you know, it feels old because people have already read about it in the newspaper, but certainly world events I will look at and try to construct something original from them by combining different elements that people may not naturally sort of put together. But, you know, taking something directly off the headlines, you know, I would never write about a bombing at the Boston Marathon or at any marathon because I would feel uncomfortable doing that. But knowing how the world works, knowing what's going on around the world, I think is very important to construct original stories that, you know, take bits and pieces from here and there.
Right. Well, your work is wildly popular around the world. Does your international readership differ from readers here in the U.S.?
I think everybody enjoys a good story. And I just came back from overseas. I was in three different countries over there. I write about, in my stories, that have universal themes, I think sort of transcends national borders, ethnicity, sort of backgrounds, culture, and all that, where I'm writing about people in various situations trying to survive and showing the impact that it can have on them, showing the decisions and choices people make and the consequences of those choices. I think people across the world can relate to those types of themes, no matter where they live and no matter who they are.
Right. I noticed in your acknowledgments you thank your audio edition narrators. Do you give actors insights into your characters before they begin the performance?
Sometimes I do. You know, they will call me up and we'll have a conversation about it. And I have a great team now that has done probably the last 7 or 8 of mine. Ron McClarty, who's a great actor on television and movies, and Orlok Cassidy, who have probably done my last half dozen or more books. The fabulous team. They do a great job together. I'm very comfortable. And I listen to the CDs because this is a whole new experience for me. I write it down, but they don't just read it. These two perform it. It's a whole another experience, and I love to listen to them.
Yeah, I think everybody does. Tell us about the Wish You Well Foundation.
My wife and I started it about 13 years ago. We fund literacy organizations and programs across the country. In pretty much all 50 states we've done now. We also have a program called Feeding Body and Mind. We partner with the food banks, Feeding America, so that I provide books to them, and those books are then shipped out to their pipeline. Over the last 4 years, I've collected books on my book tours, and that's where the books come from. Over 1 million books have been donated, and we in turn ship those out to the food banks. And the idea is that people seeking food assistance have low job skills, low literacy and reading skills. If you can heighten their literacy skills and reading skills, they get better jobs, better pay, break out of the cycle of poverty, not just for themselves, for their kids as well. It's been a hugely successful program.
Yeah, congratulations on that work. Are you already working on your new novel?
I am. I've got, it's a new King and Maxwell. I've written 5 books with them before, Sean King and Michelle Maxwell. It's also coming to television. It's going to be a network television series for TNT. It premieres on June 10th on TNT. I've seen the pilot. It's great. The same guy who does the NCIS franchise, the producer, and really excited about that. And we just finished filming Wish You Well, the movie, in Virginia last year. Just finished post-production on that. It stars Ellen Burstyn and Josh Lucas, and I'm very excited about that coming to the theaters.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
No, I really enjoyed it, too. Thank you.
Bye. And now, let's listen to a sampling from David Baldacci's The Hit, narrated by Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy.
Feeling energized by the death that was about to happen, Doug Jacobs adjusted his headset and brightened his computer screen. The picture was now crystal clear, almost as if he were there. But he thanked God he wasn't. There was thousands of miles away. But one couldn't tell that by looking at the screen. They couldn't pay him enough to be there. Besides, many people were far better suited for that job. He would be communicating shortly with one of them. Jacobs briefly glanced around the four walls and the one window of his office in the sunny Washington, D.C. neighborhood. It was an ordinary-looking low-rise brick building set in a mixed-use neighborhood that also contained historical homes in various states of either decay or restoration. But some parts of Jacobs' building were not ordinary at all. These elements included a heavy-gauge steel gate out front with a high fence around the perimeter of the property. Armed sentries patrolled the interior halls and surveillance cameras monitored the exterior. But there was nothing on the outside to clue anyone in to what was happening on the inside. And a lot was happening on the inside. Jacobs picked up his mug of fresh coffee into which he had just poured three sugar packets. Watching the screen required intense concentration. Sugar and caffeine helped him do that. It would match the emotional buzz he would have in just a few minutes. He spoke into the headset. "Alpha One, confirm location," he said crisply. It occurred to him that he sounded like an air traffic controller trying to keep the skies safe. "Well, in a way, that's exactly what I am. Only our goal is death on every trip." The response was nearly immediate.
"Alpha One, location 700 meters west of target. Sixth floor of the apartment building's east face, fourth window over from the left. You should just be able to make out the end of my rifle muzzle on a zoom in."
Jacobs leaned forward and moved his mouse, zooming in on the real-time satellite feed from this distant city that was home to many enemies of the United States. Hovering over the edge of the windowsill, he saw just the tip of a long suppressor can screwed onto a rifle's muzzle. The rifle was a customized piece of weaponry that could kill at long distances. Well, so long as a skilled hand and eye were operating it. And right now, that was the case. "Roger that, Alpha One. Cocked and locked?"
"Affirmative. All factors dialed in on scope. Crosshairs on terminal spot. Tuned frequency shifting suppressor. Setting sun behind me and in their faces. No optics reflect. Good to go."
"Copy that, Alpha One." Jacobs checked his watch. "Local time there, 1700?
"On the dot. Intel update?"
Jacobs brought this information up on a subscreen. "All on schedule. Target will be arriving in 5 minutes. He'll exit the limo on the curbside. He's scheduled to take a minute of questions on the curb, and then it's a 10-second walk into the building."
10-second walk into the building confirmed?"
"Confirmed. But the minute of interview may go longer. You play it as it goes."
"Copy that."
Jacobs refocused on the screen for a few minutes until he saw it. "Okay, motorcade is approaching."
"I see it. I've got my sight line on the straight and narrow. No obstructions."
"The crowd?"
"I've been watching the patterns of the people for the last hour. Security has roped them off. They've outlined the path he'll take for me like a lighted runway."
"Right, I can see that now." Jacobs loved being ringside for these things without actually being in the danger zone. He was compensated more generously than the person on the other end of the line. At a certain level, this made no sense at all. The shooter's was out there, and if the shot wasn't successful or the exit cues made swiftly, the gunner was dead. Back here, there would be no acknowledgement of affiliation, only a blanket denial. The shooter had no documents, no creds, no ID that would prove otherwise. The shooter would be left to hang. And in the country where this particular hit was taking place, hanging would be the shooter's fate, or perhaps beheading.
We've just heard The Hit by David Baldacci. This
year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit IBRShop.com. That's IBRShop.com, where small is beautiful. Notebook is Isabel Allende's much-anticipated new novel. Neglected by her parents, 19-year-old Maya has grown up in Berkeley with her grandparents. Her grandmother Nini is a force of nature, a woman whose strength helped her build a new life after emigrating from Chile in 1973. Popo, Maya's grandfather, is a gentleman whose solid, comforting presence helps calm Maya's turbulent adolescence. When Popo dies, Maya loses her center and turns to drugs, alcohol, and petty crime in a downward spiral that bottoms out in Las Vegas. Lost in a dangerous underworld, she's caught between warring forces. Her one chance for survival is Nini, who helps her escape to a remote island off the coast of Chile. Here, Maya tries to make sense of the past, unravels mysterious truths about her life and her family, and embarks on a journey into her own soul. Maria Cabezas performs the book.
A week ago, my grandmother gave me a dry-eyed hug at the San Francisco airport and told me again that if I valued my life at all, I should not get in touch with anyone I knew until we could be sure my enemies were no longer looking for me. My Nini is paranoid, as the residents of the People's Independent Republic of Berkeley tend to be, persecuted as they are by the government and extraterrestrials. But in my case, she wasn't exaggerating. No amount of precaution could ever be enough. She handed me a 100-page notebook so I could keep a diary, as I did from the age of 8 until I was 15, when my life went off the rails. "You're going to have time to get bored, Maya. Take advantage of it to write down the monumental stupidities you've committed. See if you can come to grips with them," she said. Several of my diaries are still in existence, sealed with industrial-strength adhesive tape. My grandfather kept them under lock and key in his desk for years, and now my Nini has them in a shoebox under her bed. This will be notebook number 9. My Nini believes they'll be of use to me when I get psychoanalyzed, because they contain the keys to untie the knots of my personality. But if she'd read them, she'd know they contain a huge pile of tales, tall enough to outfox Freud himself. My grandmother distrusts on principle professionals who charge by the hour, since quick results are not profitable for them. However, she makes an exception for psychiatrists, because one of them saved her from depression and from the traps of magic, when she took it into her head to communicate with the dead. I put the notebook in my backpack, so I wouldn't upset her, with no intention of using it. But it's true that time stretches out here, and writing is one way of filling up the hours. This first week of exile has been a long one for me. I'm on a tiny island so small it's almost invisible on the map, in the middle of the Dark Ages. It's complicated to write about my life, because I don't know how much I actually remember and how much is a product of my imagination. The bare truth can be tedious, and so, without even noticing, I change or exaggerate it. But I intend to correct this defect and lie as little as possible in the future. And that's why now, when even the Yanomamis of the Amazonas use computers, I am writing by hand. It takes me ages, and my writing must be in Cyrillic script, because I can't even decipher it myself, but I imagine it'll gradually straighten out page by page. Writing is like riding a bicycle. You don't forget how, even if you go for years without doing it. I'm trying to go in chronological order, since some sort of order is required, and I thought that would make it easy. But I lose my thread. I go off on tangents, or I remember something important several pages later, and there's no way to fit it in. My memory goes in circles, spirals, and somersaults. My name is Maya Vidal. I'm 19 years old, female, single, due to a lack of opportunities rather than by choice. I'm currently without a boyfriend. Born in Berkeley, California, I'm a U.S. citizen and temporarily taking refuge on an island at the bottom of the world. They named me Maya because my Nini has a soft spot for India, and my parents hadn't come up with any other name, even though they'd had 9 months to think about it. In Hindi, Maya means charm, illusion, dream. Nothing at all to do with my personality. Attila would suit me better, because wherever I step, no pasture will ever grow again. My story begins in Chile with my grandmother, my Nini, a long time before I was born, because if she hadn't emigrated, she'd never have fallen in love with my popo or moved to California. My father would never have met my mother, and I wouldn't be me, but rather a very different Chilean girl. What do I look like? I'm 5'10", 128 pounds when I play soccer, and several more if I don't watch out.
We've just heard Maya's Notebook by Isabel Allende. Rogue Island, Bruce De Silva's debut novel, garnered praise from every corner and recently won one of the Mystery Writers of America's coveted Edgar Awards. Liam Mulligan is as old school as a newspaper man can get. His beat is Providence, Rhode Island, where he knows every street and alley, every priest and prostitute, all the cops and street thugs, and the mobsters and politicians, who are pretty much one and the same. Someone is systematically burning down Mulligan's neighborhood. People he knows are perishing in the flames, and the public is on the verge of panic. With the police looking for answers in all the wrong places, Mulligan sets out to find the hand that strikes the match. Jeff Woodman narrates.
The fireman who descended with the little girl had already wrapped her in a sheet. The EMTs slid the children into the back of an ambulance and fishtailed down the rutted street with lights flashing, as if there was still a reason to hurry. The 16-year-old babysitter looked catatonic as she watched the taillights disappear in the dark. Battalion Chief Rosella Morelli knocked the icicles off the brim of her fire hat. Then she whacked her gloved fist against the side of the gleaming red pumper. "You countin'?" I asked. "Makes 9 major fires in Mount Hope in 3 months," she said, "and 5 dead." The neighborhood of Mount Hope, wedged between an old barge canal and the swanky east side, had been nailed together before the First World War to house the city's swelling class of immigrant mill workers. Even then, decades before the mills closed and the jobs moved to South Carolina on their way to Mexico and Indonesia, it hadn't been much to look at. Now lead paint flaked from the sagging porches of tinderbox triple-deckers. Flimsy cottages, many built without garages or driveways in an age of streetcars and shoe leather, smelled of dry rot in summer and wet rot in winter. Corroding Kenmores and Frigidaires crouched in the weeds that sprouted after the city dynamited the old Nelson Aldrich Junior High, where Mr. McCready first introduced me to Ray Bradbury and John Steinbeck. The neighborhood's straight, narrow streets, many named for varieties of trees that refused to grow there anymore, crisscrossed a gentle slope that offered occasional glimpses of downtown office towers and the marble dome of the State House. Real estate agents, fingers crossed behind their backs, called them vistas. Mount Hope may not have been Providence's best neighborhood, but it wasn't its worst either. A quarter of the 2,600 families proudly owned their own homes. A community crime watch had cut down on the burglaries. Only 16% of the toddlers had lead poisoning from all that peeling paint, downright healthy compared to the predominantly black and Asian neighborhood of South Providence, where the figure topped 40%. And 5 dead meant business was picking up at Lugo's Mortuary, the neighborhood's biggest legal business, now that Deegan's auto body had morphed into a chop shop and Mafio's used cars had given way to a heroin dealership. The battalion chief watched her crew aim a jet of water through the twins' bedroom window. "I'm getting real tired of notifying next of kin," she said. "Thank God you haven't lost any of your men." She turned from the smoldering building and hit me with a withering glare, the same one she used to shame me when she caught me cheating at chutes and ladders when we were both 6 years old. "You're saying I should count my blessings?" she said. "Just stay safe, Rosie." The glare softened a little. "Yeah, you too," she said, although in my job, the worst that was likely to happen was a paper cut.
We've just heard Rogue Island by Bruce Da Silva. The Dinner by Herman Koch takes place on a summer's eve in Amsterdam. Two couples meet at a fashionable restaurant for dinner. Table talk is a gentle hum of polite discourse about work, the holidays, and other trivialities. But behind the empty words, terrible things need to be said. And with every forced smile and new course, the knives are being sharpened. Each couple has a 15-year-old son. The two boys are united by their accountability for a single horrific act, an act that has triggered a police investigation and shattered the comfortable, insulated worlds of their families. As dinner reaches its culinary climax, the conversation finally turns to their children. As civility and friendship disintegrate, each couple shows just how far they are prepared to go to protect those they love. The book is performed by Clive Mantell.
If you don't scrape off the day's stubble, you are too lazy to shave. 2 days' beard immediately makes them wonder whether this is some new look. 3 days or more is just a step from total dissolution. Are you feeling all right? You're not sick, are you? Oh, no matter what you do, you're not free. You shave, but you're not free. Shaving is a statement as well. Apparently, you found this evening significant enough to go to the trouble of shaving. You see the others thinking. In fact, shaving already puts you behind 1-0. And then I always have Claire to remind me that this isn't an evening like every other. Claire is smarter than I am. I'm not saying that out of some half-baked feminist sentiment or in order to endear women to me. You'll never hear me claim that women in general are smarter than men, or more sensitive, more intuitive, or that they are more in touch with life, or any of the other. But when all is said and done, so-called sensitive men try to peddle more often than women themselves. Claire just happens to be smarter than I am. I can honestly say that it took me a while to admit that. During our first years together, I thought she was intelligent, I guess, but intelligent in the usual sense. Precisely as intelligent, in fact, as you might expect my wife to be. After all, would I settle for a stupid woman for any longer than a month? In any case, Claire was intelligent enough for me to stay with her even after the first month. And now, almost 20 years later, that hasn't changed. So, Claire is smarter than I am. But on evenings like this, she still asks my opinion about what she should wear. Which earrings? Whether to wear her hair up or leave it down? For women, earrings are sort of what shaving is for men. The bigger the earrings, the more significant, the more festive the evening. Claire has earrings for every occasion. Some people might say it's not smart to be so insecure about what you wear, but that's not how I see it. The stupid woman is the one who thinks she doesn't need any help. What does a man know about things like that? The stupid woman thinks and proceeds to make the wrong choice. I've sometimes tried to imagine Babette asking Serge whether she's wearing the right dress, whether her hair isn't too long, what Serge thinks of these shoes. The heels aren't too flat, are they? Or maybe too high?
We've just heard The Dinner by Herman Koch, translation by Sam Garrett. Aviator his wife, Melanie Benjamin pulls back the curtain on the marriage of one of America's most extraordinary couples, Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. For much of her life, Anne Morrow, shy daughter of the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, stood in the shadows of those around her, including her millionaire father and vibrant older sister. One Christmas, Anne, then a college senior with literary aspirations, traveled to Mexico City to spend the holiday with her family. There she met Colonel Charles Lindbergh, fresh off his celebrated solo flight across the Atlantic. Enthralled by Charles's fame, Anne felt the celebrated aviator scarcely noticed her. But she was wrong. Charles saw in Anne a kindred spirit, a fellow adventurer. The two married in a headline-making wedding. Hounded by adoring crowds and hunted by an insatiable press, Charles attempted to shield them from prying eyes, leaving Anne to feel her life falling back in the shadows. In the years that followed, despite her own major achievements, including becoming the first American licensed female glider pilot, Anne was viewed only as the aviator's wife. Drawing on rich history of the 20th century, from the late 20s to the mid-60s, The Aviator's Wife is a vividly imagined novel of a complicated marriage. Lorna Raver narrates.
Down to earth. I repeated the phrase to myself, whispering it in wonder. Down to earth. What a plodding expression, really, when you considered it. I couldn't help but think of muddy fields and wheel ruts and worms. Yet, people always meant it as a compliment. Down to earth. Did you hear that, Elizabeth? Can you believe Daddy would say that about an aviator, of all people? I doubt he even realized what he was saying, my sister murmured as she scribbled furiously on her lap desk, despite the rocking motion of the train. Now, Anne, dear, if you just let me finish this letter. Of course he didn't, I persisted, refusing to be ignored. This was the third letter she'd written today. Daddy never does know what he's saying, which is why I love him. But honestly, that's what his letter said. I do hope you can meet Colonel Lindbergh. He's so down to earth. Well, Daddy is quite taken with the Colonel. Oh, I know, and I didn't mean to criticize him. I was just thinking out loud. I wouldn't say anything like that in person. Suddenly, my mood shifted, as it always seemed to do whenever I was with my family. Away from them, I could be confident, almost careless with my words and ideas. Once, someone even called me vivacious. Although, to be honest, he was a college freshman intoxicated by bathtub gin and his first whiff of expensive perfume. Whenever my immediate family gathered, however, it took me a while to relax, to reacquaint myself with the rhythm of speech and good-natured joshing that they seemed to fall into so readily. I imagined that they carried it with them, even when we were all scattered. I fancied each one of them humming the tune of this family symphony in their heads as they went about their busy lives. Like so many other family traits, the famous Morrow sense of humor, for instance, the musical gene appeared to have skipped me. So it always took me longer to remember my part in this domestic song and dance. I'd been traveling with my sister and brother on this Mexican-bound train for a week, and still I felt tongue-tied and shy, particularly around Dwight, now a senior at Groton. My brother had grown paler, prone to strange laughing fits, almost reverting to childhood at times, even as physically he was fast maturing into a carbon copy of our father. Elizabeth was the same as ever, and I was the same as ever around her. No longer a confident college senior, I was diminished in her golden presence. In the stale air of the train car, I felt as limp and wrinkled as the sad linen dress I was wearing. while she looked as pressed and poised as a mannequin, not a wrinkle or smudge on her smart silk suit, despite the red dust blowing in through the inadequate windows. Now, don't go brooding already, Anne, for heaven's sake. Of course you wouldn't criticize Daddy to his face, you of all people. There. Elizabeth signed her letter with a flourish, folded it carefully, and tucked it in her pocket. I'll wait until later before I address it. Just think how grand it will look on the embassy stationery. Who are you writing this time, Connie? Elizabeth nodded brusquely. She wrote to Connie Chilton, her former roommate from Smith, so frequently the question hardly seemed worth acknowledging. Then I almost asked if she needed a stamp before I remembered. We were dignitaries now. Daddy was ambassador to Mexico. We Maros had no need for such common objects as stamps. All our letters would go in the special government mail pouch, along with Daddy's memos and reports. It was rumored that Colonel Lindbergh himself would be taking a mail pouch back to Washington with him when he flew away. At least, that's what Daddy had insinuated in his last letter, the one I had received just before boarding the train in New York with Elizabeth and Dwight.
That was a sample of The Aviator's Wife by Melanie Benjamin. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. In The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie, Alan Brady introduces one of the most engaging heroines in recent fiction, 11-year-old Flavia DeLuce, an aspiring chemist with a passion for poison. In the summer of 1950, a series of inexplicable events strikes the decaying English mansion Flavia's family calls home. A dead bird is found on the doorstep, a postage stamp pinned to its beak. Hours later, Flavia finds a man lying in a cucumber patch and watches as he takes his dying breath. To Flavia, the investigation is the stuff of science, full of possibilities, contradictions, and connections. Soon her father, a man raising his three daughters alone, is seized and accused of murder. In a police cell, Colonel DeLuce tells his daughter an astounding story, that of a schoolboy friendship turned ugly, of a priceless object that vanished, and of a Latin teacher who flung himself to death from the school's tower 30 years before. Now Flavia is armed with more than enough knowledge to tie the two distant deaths together, to examine new suspects, and begin a search that will lead to the King of England himself. Jane Entwistle narrates.
It was all Ophelia's fault. She was, after all, 17, and therefore expected to possess at least a modicum of the maturity she should come into as an adult. That she should gang up with Daphne, who was 13, simply wasn't fair. Their combined ages totaled 30 years. 30 years against my 11. It was not only unsporting, it was downright rotten. And it simply screamed out for revenge. Next morning, I was busy among the flasks and flagons of my chemical laboratory on the top floor of the East Wing when Ophelia barged in without so much as a la-di-da. "Where's my pearl necklace?" I shrugged. "I'm not the keeper of your trinkets." "I know you took it. The mint imperials that were in my lingerie drawer are gone too, and I've observed that missing mints in this household seem always to wind up in the same grubby little mouth." I adjusted the flame on a spirit lamp that was heating a beaker of red liquid. "If you're insinuating that my personal hygiene is not up to the same high standard as yours, you can go suck my galoshes." "Flavia?" "Well, you can. I'm sick and tired of being blamed for everything, Feely." But my righteous indignation was cut short as Ophelia peered short-sightedly into the ruby flask, which was just coming to the boil. "What's that sticky mass in the bottom?" Her long manicured fingernail tapped at the glass. "It's an experiment. Careful, Feely, it's acid." Ophelia's face went white. "Those are my pearls. They belong to Mummy." Ophelia was the only one of Harriet's daughters who referred to her as Mummy, the only one of us old enough to have any real memories of the flesh-and-blood woman who had carried us in her body, a fact of which Ophelia never tired of reminding us. Harriet had been killed in a mountaineering accident when I was just a year old, and she was not often spoken of at Buckshaw. Was I jealous of Ophelia's memories? Did I resent them? I don't believe I did. It ran far deeper than that. In rather an odd way, I despised Ophelia's memories of our mother. I looked up slowly from my work so that the round lenses of my spectacles would flash blank white semaphores of light at her. I knew that whenever I did this, Ophelia had the horrid impression that she was in the presence of some mad black-and-white German scientist in a film at the Gaumont. "Beast! Hag!" I retorted. But not until Ophelia had spun round on a heel, quite neatly, I thought, and stormed out the door. Retribution was not long in coming, but then with Ophelia, it never was. Ophelia was not, as I was, a long-range planner who believed in letting the soup of revenge simmer to perfection. Quite suddenly after dinner, with Father safely retired to his study to gloat over his collection of paper heads, Ophelia had too quietly put down the silver butter knife in which, like a budgerigar, she had been regarding her own reflection for the last quarter of an hour. Without preamble, she said, "I'm not really your sister, you know, nor is Daphne. That's why we're so unlike you. I don't suppose it's ever even occurred to you that you're adopted." I dropped my spoon with a clatter. "That's not true. I'm the spitting image of Harriet. Everybody says so." "She picked you out at the Home for Unwed Mothers because of the striking resemblance," Ophelia said, making a distasteful face. "How could there be a resemblance when she was an adult and I was a baby?" I was nothing if not quick on the uptake. "Because you reminded her of her own baby pictures. Good Lord, she even dragged them along and held them up beside you for comparison." I appealed to Daphne, whose nose was firmly stuck in a leather-bound copy of The Castle of Otranto. "That's not true, is it, Daffy?" "'Fraid so," Daphne said, idly turning an onion-skin page. "Father always said it would come as a bit of a shock to you. He made both of us swear never to tell, or at least until you were 11. He made us take an oath."
We've just heard The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie by Alan Bradley. A mesmerizing, moving, and elegantly written debut novel, Vanessa Dieffenbach's The Language of Flowers weaves past and present, creating a vivid portrait of a woman whose gift for flowers helps her change the lives of others and perhaps her own. The Victorian language of flowers was used to convey romantic expressions, honeysuckle for devotion, red roses for love. But for Victoria Jones, flowers convey only solitude. After a childhood spent in foster care, she's unable to get close to anyone. Her only tie to the world is through flowers and their meanings. Now 18 and on her own, Victoria has nowhere to go. She sleeps in a public park where she plants a small garden of her own. Soon, a local florist discovers her talent, and Victoria realizes she has a gift for helping others through the flowers she chooses for them. But a mysterious flower vendor has her questioning what's missing in her life. When she is forced to confront a painful secret, she must decide whether it's worth risking everything for a chance at happiness. Tara Sands narrates.
These girls knew their prospects. In their eyes was nothing but fear. Of me, of their housemates, of the life they had earned or been given. I felt an unexpected rush of pity. I was leaving. They had no choice but to stay. I tried to push my way toward the door, but the girl stepped to the side, blocking my path. "Move," I said. A young woman working the night shift poked her head out of the kitchen. She was probably not yet 20, and more terrified of me than any of the girls in the room. "Please," she said, her voice begging. "This is her last morning. Just let her go." I waited, ready, as the girl before me pulled her stomach in, fists clenched tight. But after a moment, she shook her head and turned away. I walked around her. I had an hour before Meredith would come for me. Opening the front door, I stepped outside. It was a foggy San Francisco morning, the concrete porch cool on my bare feet. I paused, thinking. I'd planned to gather a response for the girls, something biting and hateful, but I felt strangely forgiving. Maybe it was because I was 18, because all at once it was over for me, that I was able to feel tenderness toward their crime. Before I left, I wanted to say something to combat the fear in their eyes. Walking down Fell, I turned onto Market. My steps slowed as I reached a busy intersection, unsure of where to go. Any other day, I would have plucked annuals from DuBose Park, scoured the overgrown lot at Page and Buchanan, or stolen herbs from the neighborhood market. For most of a decade, I'd spent every spare moment memorizing the meanings and scientific descriptions of individual flowers. But the knowledge went mostly unutilized. I used the same flowers again and again. A bouquet of marigold, grief. A bucket of thistle, misanthropy. A pinch of dried basil, hate. Only occasionally did my communication vary. A pocketful of red carnations for the judge when I realized I would never go back to the vineyard. And peony for Meredith, as often as I could find it. Now, searching Market Street for a florist, I scoured my mental dictionary. After three blocks, I came to a liquor store, where paper-wrapped bouquets wilted in buckets under the barred windows. I paused in front of the store. They were mostly mixed arrangements, their messages conflicting. The selection of solid bouquets was small. Standard roses in red and pink, a wilting bunch of striped carnations, and bursting from its paper cone, a cluster of purple dahlias. Dignity. Immediately, I knew it was the message I wanted to give. Turning my back to the angled mirror above the door, I tucked the flowers inside my coat and ran. I was out of breath by the time I returned to the house. The living room was empty, and I stepped inside to unwrap the dahlias. The flowers were perfect starbursts, layers of white-tipped purple petals unfurling from tight buds of a center. Biting off an elastic band, I detangled the stems. The girls would never understand the meaning of the dahlias, the meaning itself an ambiguous statement of encouragement. Even so, I felt an unfamiliar lightness as I paced the long hall, slipping a stem under each closed bedroom door. The remaining flowers I gave to the young woman who'd worked the night shift. She was standing by the kitchen window, waiting for her replacement. "Thank you," she said when I handed her the bouquet, confusion in her voice. She twirled the stiff stems between her palms. Meredith arrived at 10 o'clock, as she told me she would. I waited on the front porch, a cardboard box balanced on my thighs. In 18 years, I'd collected mostly books, The Dictionary of Flowers and Peterson Field Guide to Pacific States Wildflowers, both sent to me by Elizabeth a month after I left her home, botany textbooks from libraries all over the East Bay, thin paperback volumes of Victorian poetry stolen from quiet bookstores.
That was The Language of Flowers by Vanessa Diefenbaugh. One of the preeminent humorists of our generation, David Sedaris invites readers into his world to meet and mingle with his very unique perspective. In Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, we travel along with David on a bizarre world tour. His new collection of essays delves into, for example, the perils of French dentistry, the eating habits of the Australian kookaburra, and the peculiarity of Beijing's squat-style toilets.
Whether rallying against the habits of litterers in the English countryside or marveling over a human arm in a taxidermy shop, Sedaris' adventures are always worth the trip, the author narrates.
He stepped into the back room and returned with what I could only identify as a creature. "What we've done," he boasted, "is stretch a chicken over an owl form." "That's really something," I said, groping for a compliment. The truth was that even a child would have seen this for what it was, the beak made from what looked to be a bear claw, the feet with their worn-down pedestrian talons. I mean, please, this was what a chicken might wear to a Halloween party if she had 10 minutes to throw a costume together. "Let me think about it," I said. Years later, we moved to Paris, where within my first week, I found an albino peacock. I found swans and storks and all manner of seabirds, but again, no owls, because stuffing them is forbidden in France. In the UK, though, it's a slightly different story. You can't go out and shoot one, certainly. They're protected in life just as they are in the US, but afterward, in death, things loosen up a bit. Most of the owls I saw in Great Britain had been stuffed during the Victorian era. I'd see them at English flea markets and in Scottish antique shops. But as is always the case, the moment you decide to buy one, they're nowhere to be had. I needed one, or decided I did, in February 2008. Hugh and I were moving from our apartment to a house in Kensington. And after going through our owl objects and deciding we could do without 9/10 of them, I thought I'd get him the real thing for Valentine's Day. Should have started looking a month or two in advance, but with Christmas and packing and helping to ready our new place, it had slipped my mind. Thus, I wound up on February 13th, calling a London taxidermy shop and asking if they had any owls. The person who answered the phone told me that he had two of them, both recent specimens and freestanding, not behind glass as most of the old ones are. The store was open only by appointment, and after arranging to come by the following afternoon, I went to where Hugh was packing books in the next room and said, "I am giving you the best Valentine's Day gift ever." This is one of those things I do and immediately hate myself for. How is the other person supposed to respond? What's the point? For the first 18 years we were together, I'd give Hugh chocolates for Valentine's Day, and he'd give me a carton of cigarettes. Both of us got exactly what we wanted, and it couldn't have been easier. Then I quit smoking and decided that in place of cigarettes, I needed, say, an 18th-century scientific model of the human throat. It was life-size, about 4 inches long, and because it was old, handmade, and designed to be taken apart for study, it cost quite a bit of money. "When did Valentine's Day turn into this?" Hugh asked, when I told him he had to buy it for me. What could I say? Like everything else, holiday gifts escalate. The presents get better and better until one year you decide you don't need anything else and start making donations to animal shelters. Even if you hate cats and dogs, you're somehow always the ones who benefit. "Eventually, we'll celebrate by spaying a few dozen kittens," I said, "but until that day comes, I want that throat." On Valentine's Day, I carried a few boxes from our apartment to the house we'd bought. It looked like the sort of place where Scrooge might have lived, a narrow brick building, miserly in terms of space, and joined to identical, equally grim houses on either side of it. From there, I walked around the corner and got on the underground. The taxidermy shop was on a quiet street in North London, and as I approached, I saw a man and his two sons with their faces pressed against the barred front windows. "A polar bear," one of the boys shouted. The other tugged on his father's coat. "And a penguin! Look at the baby penguin!" My heart raced. The man who owned the shop was so much taller than me that in order to look him in the eye, I had to throw my head all the way back, like I do at the dentist's office. He had enviably thick hair, and as he opened the door to let me in, I noticed an orange kitten positioned on the floor beside a Dalmatian puppy. Casting a shadow upon them was a rabbit standing upright on its hind legs, and above him, on a shelf, sat two tawny owls, each mounted to a stump and standing around 20 inches high.
That was Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls by David Sedaris. Readers, I hope you enjoy the holiday, the barbecues, the gatherings, and a chance to have a bit more time to enjoy a good book. For more Beachbound titles, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and let's meet again next week on The Book Report.